Hello, everybody. How you doing? Hope all is well. Welcome to another lecture. And this is going to be a lecture that hopefully encourages us to take full advantage of our final take-home exercises, and also one that hopefully gives us a sense of purpose in regards to keeping philosophy in our lives after the class is over. So that being said, I want to do a little bit of a lecture examining the different types of training we get when we practice philosophical meditation through self-writing. So I'm hoping the little bit of extra research I present to all of you today, some other philosophical insights, again, might encourage us to keep philosophy in our lives. Right. So on that note, I want to briefly share a quick quote from Marcus Aurelius' Meditations that I think gets this conversation started pretty nicely. So of course, we're keeping in mind that his meditations were written for himself. So he himself is giving himself a sense of encouragement here to continue sticking with philosophy, to keep it sort of at his side, if you will, or keep it ready at hand to deal with life. So on that note, I'm going to read a little bit here. He wrote to himself, quote, "In brief, the things of the body are unstable as water. The things of the soul, dreams, and vaporous. Life itself is a warfare or a trip in a strange land. What then shall be our guide and escort? One thing, and only one, philosophy." So of course, for Marcus, this might have been his only approach, but as I hope I made clear in earlier lectures, right, philosophy does not have to replace anything else in your life necessarily, but I do think it makes a great addition, right? So of course you can fill in the blank with other things that might provide you with peace, guidance, right? Like philosophy could or did for Marcus, let's say. So let's keep our minds open to that, of course. Ultimately though, I do think he's offering something really good here, right? Life can be difficult, of course, right? But this idea of philosophy as guide, as companion, it's something I hope we consider strongly, right? So even taking a minute right now, if you can, reflect, what are some philosophers, even one philosopher, that really resonated with you, that you really connected with their thinking? If you email me, I'll do my best to get back to you, you know, even after the class, of course. If you want recommendations for books, other philosophers, please reach out. I'll do my best. Because again, for me, one of my aspirations is that the class kind of lives on, if you will, or at the very least, we could say in a better way, you continue to practice and study philosophy after the class. That's a better way of phrasing it, right? Because the class will end, right? I have to give you a final grade, of course. And we won't be, you know, I won't be emailing you with homework every week, right? That being said, my hope is that philosophy has given you something such that you want to stick with it, right? So think about the philosopher or philosophers. Think about the key ideas that really resonated with you. Think about the questions that really stood out to you, the texts, maybe the readings that we did, maybe some lectures, right? Conversations that hopefully some of our work together sparked between you and friends and family, right? And then use those as starting points. The class ending is not an ending point. It's a starting point. It's my, again, my hope. So on that note, the next kind of section of the lecture is going to elaborate on what I see as kind of a general idea that we're hopefully cultivating throughout the semester, and one that, again, you might continue to pursue. And then within that, sort of smaller, well, not necessarily smaller ideas, but ideas that I think lead to this state, right? So what I'm referring to essentially is the concept of leisure. And I'm going to define that for us in a little bit, in a slightly different way than what we might be used to, or let's say in a way that might be different than what first comes to mind when I use that word leisure, right? So what I think for me, at least even before I did this research myself, you know, I would conceive of or understand leisure as like basically not working, right? On vacation, right? We're going to reconceptualize that a little bit. Then we're going to build a little more meaning into that word. And then we're also going to examine philosophical meditation, which is what we've been doing every week, right? When I do our guided meditation, the way we define philosophical meditation, of course, in our book, I think we also discussed it earlier, right? It's the examination of ourselves through questions. It's the taking time out of our day to sit and think and sit and write with ourselves as a subject, with our society, our world, as is a subject. And we use questions to kind of fuel that, to motivate that, right? So we're going to talk about what kind of is foundational to that practice. Well, we're hopefully going to talk about the power and then apply it of silence, right? We're going to even interpret silence a little bit in a couple ways, right? And the power of questioning. And we're also going to do quick examinations of the power of writing, which I think we've already discussed a little bit, right? And also the therapeutic and philosophical nature of reading, right? So we're going to hopefully break these ideas down, break these ideas that sort of, let's say, compose philosophical meditation and self-writing philosophically to give us a little bit of encouragement to keep it going, right? And of course, we're sort of pursuing philosophy as the art of living and leisure as an, you know, really important part of that concept. All right, so let's talk about leisure. I think an interesting definition, or at least a starting point to understand leisure, is a definition I found in a book called Stand Out of Our Light, Freedom and Resistance in the Attention Economy by James Williams. So what he offers in regards to leisure is, quote, leisure can be understood as unstructured downtime that serves as the ground out of which one's true self bubbles forth. So at the heart of this idea is the pursuit of self-knowledge. At the heart of this idea is the Socratic notion we get from the Apology, right? To care for one's soul. And in the ancient Greek conception of that, right, the Oracle of Delphi, as we know, charged Socrates to go out and pursue wisdom, essentially, right? To go out and see who was the wisest, because the oracle told him he was in disbelief, right? What we didn't get to discuss, and I'm glad to be sharing it now, is that in ancient Greek culture, the idea of know yourself was very closely coupled with and paired with the idea of care for yourself, right? So leisure, we could see it as time during which we're caring for ourselves in a Socratic sense, which is to say caring for our souls. We need time for that, right? So our modern conception of leisure as, let's just say, pleasure-driven or pleasure-oriented is not really grasping the full power of this idea, right? Because although pleasure can play, I think, a healthy role in our lives, this classical conception or understanding of leisure is different than that. Again, it doesn't necessarily, let's say, exclude pleasure, but it's working with this idea of the self, right? The true self bubbling forth. So when we're practicing our philosophical meditation and you're really taking those questions seriously, right? You're almost kind of like, let's say, you're definitely engaging with yourself, right? But you're encouraging yourself to, as Williams is saying here, kind of bubble forth, right? You're looking inwards and then things are kind of rising up in a sense, right? And then we could even take that to the next step, right? Which is to say that we can then understand ourselves and then move forward in life more effectively, right? So there's sort of a different set of, let's say, directions that we're allowing ourselves to create for ourselves, with ourselves, when we learn to practice leisure as unstructured downtime that serves as the ground, right? And even think of, I love this line, right? Think about ground. The ground is fertile, right? That's where food comes from. That's where our nourishment comes from. So there's something profoundly spiritual and philosophical about embracing this type of leisure, right? And not simply seeing leisure as vacation or simply seeing leisure as a time when we're not at work. So when we practice philosophical meditation, when we make time for self-writing, we're really asking ourselves to understand leisure. When we allow ourselves, right, to pursue questions in wonder, there's a lack of structure there. And that lack of structure allows this sort of coming forth. Or let's even say we call our true selves forth when we practice philosophical meditation through self-writing, or even just philosophical meditation without self-writing. And we'll talk about the advantages of writing and reading in a moment. But even just taking time to think about questions, right? Questions, as we're going to discuss in a moment, right, are the engines of reason for Epictetus. So they encourage us to think and apply our rational thinking to ourselves and our world. And that is a beautiful idea, right? That is serving, again, that fertile ground for new things, for the pursuit of truth, for the pursuit of a self that is, let's say, transcendent of our current selves. Right? So why bother with leisure? Well, this is why we should bother with leisure. And what this book really discusses, right, the book by Williams, once again, Stand Out of Our Light, Freedom and Resistance in the Attention Economy, is the fact that our ability to practice leisure is kind of under attack, right? The attention economy for Williams is kind of constantly, let's say, providing us with stimulus. It's constantly almost like goading us and prodding us, right, to not have leisure time, right? He's saying in this idea, it's a wonderful idea that he calls the daylight, right? The daylight for him, these are our fundamental capacities, such as reflection, metacognition, reason, and intelligence that enable us to define our goals and values, right? The attention economy is detracting from our ability to do that, to take those ideas seriously, to give those ideas time. Right? It's affecting our ability to know ourselves and to know our world. Okay? Because the pursuit of self-knowledge and self-care requires time in reflection, right? In leisure. Right? These ideas of reflection and leisure are very closely connected for Williams, right? As they have been hopefully for us in this class. Right? We're called to a state of reflection that is inherently a part of leisure if it's authentic and focused, concentrated, right? Right, and for another philosopher that Williams referenced named Christine Korsgaard, that's Korsgaard, right? She tells us that reflection is a pathway to, quote, turn our attention onto our own mental activities so we can, quote, call our beliefs and motives into question. Right, and for Williams, the omnipresence of phones, the phone's always there, right, with the constant buzzing of notifications, right? For him, he highlights this wonderfully, right? The average cell phone user checks their phone 150 times a day and touches the phone over 2,600 times per day, right? And for him, that really crowds out our ability to practice leisure. It almost takes away our daily opportunities to take advantage of a free moment. Right? And not only does it kind of crowd out the free moment, but it's training our minds to not do anything but check the phone, to have these short engagements with the phone and kind of ignore these other opportunities and skills we could cultivate, which again, hopefully we've been cultivating in the class. Right? So this idea of leisure is something that we have to attend to. Another philosopher I want to highlight for a quick second here is Michael Oakeshott. Right, what he tells us is that, quote, a large part of human conduct is, and always has been, concerned with exploiting the resources of Earth. So that's what work, a lot of the times, right, is, more or less. But he tells us there's more to being human than that. Right, and that more to being human, I think, for Oakeshott and other thinkers, involves addressing, like, life's bigger questions. And that's bigger questions about the world, about the universe, and bigger questions, of course, about ourselves. Right, I mentioned in my last section of this lecture, right, we're kind of returning to our general sense of purpose. One of the kind of strangest moments for me, and I, as someone who does philosophy and tries to live philosophically, I'm sure I'm not alone in this, is when we address that question of, like, why are you here? Well, we start off with the small, why are you in this class? Why are you at this institution? Why are you taking your major, right? And then the bigger one of, like, well, why are you on this earth? It's kind of an awe-inspiring question, right? That's a beautiful moment, a moment of wonder, a moment where we feel challenged, right? We may be, and I think Oakeshott and a lot of other philosophers, right, make this argument, like, that's a naturally human thing to do that we can't ignore. As much as the world tries to encourage us not to address it with the constant distractions and the constant other motives and reasons to do things, we need to have this type of reason. We need to have, for example, a larger sense of why. If for no other reason that it's just a part of being a human. So when we practice leisure, and we could, again, we're going to talk about how we can work in other ideas to the, you know, into this that are very significant. We have to maybe re-examine, or I hope we re-examine if we need to, right? Some of our daily activities. Maybe we can make time for this type of leisure, and I hope this class has been an opportunity for that, right? Another philosopher, Kevin Gary, highlights, quote, "Leisure is a disappearing good. Talk of schools as places for leisure sounds increasingly anachronistic. And what counts as leisure today is a pale imitation of the leisure ideal inspired by Greek and Hebraic traditions. Rather than a rich and robust alternative to work, leisure has been co-opted by work, defined negatively and simply as the absence of work. So it's not just that you're not working. There's something rich here. There's something valuable here. And I think for a lot of these philosophers, that rich, valuable thing is this ability to know yourself, care for yourself, and ultimately pursue what you find to be valuable. Right? As Williams was saying earlier, right? You can and should work to define your sense of self, your sense of your future self, which is to say your purpose and your major goals and your major mission in life. That requires time. That also, for Williams, in a very significant sense, requires attention. In a literal sense, you have to pay attention to it. And the more you pay attention to it, the better you get at paying attention to it. The more effective your attention becomes, and the richer your engagement with leisure becomes. The more articulately you can learn how to listen to yourself and talk to yourself and write about or write to yourself in a sense, right? In that Marcus Aurelius meditation sense. And have those conversations be meaningful, and they could bring you joy. They could bring you peace. They can push you forward in life. All of that is through leisure. We can train leisure and have it be something that's rich and robust, as Gary's offering us here. Right, for Gary too, leisure involves a humble and intense practice of self-examination. Once again, very much in line, hopefully, with what we've been doing throughout the semester in our philosophical meditations, in our self-writing, and also, as we'll talk about too, in our reading. All of these things are pathways to self-knowledge, self-care, and this authentic classical sense of leisure. That is not the absence, or is not only the absence of, let's say, quote, work in our modern sense, but it's the presence of work on the self that is enjoyable and important and meaningful for us. So I hope this brief conversation on leisure would once again encourage us to cultivate a good relationship with philosophical meditation, a good relationship with certain philosophers, maybe a reading habit that encourages us to work on ourselves. Or let's say, hopefully, to continue working on ourselves, because maybe we did that in the class. Based on a number of, you know, of the assignments, I think I'm encouraging that. And honestly, based on all the pretty much all the reading I've done this semester, it seems like we're doing that. We've embraced that idea. And that's been great for me to read. So again, leisure is important in and of itself, where we want to call forth these important moments of self-knowledge, self-care. We want to call forth our capacity to define our purposes by giving time, by carving out time, training that attention. And again, maybe it's philosophical meditation through self-writing. We're going to break that down right now. So, we've been practicing philosophical meditation every week, hopefully also with self-writing. And of course, for our final take-home exercise, a large portion of that is very similar to, if not, really is another mode of philosophical meditation with self-writing. So, in my opinion, when we're practicing philosophical meditation, especially with self-writing, we're also getting training in some really important things that I think even in and of themselves can be really significant for us, right? In terms of philosophy as the art of living. So those four things are: one, silence; two, questioning; three, of course, writing; and four, reading. So when we practice these things in this mode, right, we're going to get certain benefits. So right away, I want to define silence a little bit broadly here. I don't only mean, although it can mean, silence is the complete absence of noise. Again, it can be, but I also think silence could be, and this is a strange word, wordlessness, right? So a time of the day when you're not speaking and no one's speaking to you, right? And I also think listening to music without lyrics is a pathway to this, so instrumental music. And I also think that, and this is a point I take from Albert Camus that I actually practice in my daily life constantly, listening to music in a language you don't understand. I'm not sure if I've recommended this yet on the podcast, but I always recommend this to students in class. I stand by this. I listen to more music in languages I cannot understand than I do listen to music in languages I can understand. And I find that when I cannot understand the music, it helps me be way more creative. And I don't know if there's something to that, but what we'll see with silence in a little bit, when I share some reflections on it, it does sort of encourage this engagement with the self that is very creative. Right. So as I remarked earlier on questioning, because that's how we start our philosophical meditations, right? We see the questions, and I'm suggesting here, and we may have been practicing this already throughout the semester, right? If we were in class together, this would be a 10 to 15 minute period each class where no one would have been speaking. Right. And I would have encouraged you to listen to music that was instrumental, or again, in a language you don't understand, to help facilitate the writing. Right. So that being said, we want to start off with the idea that, once again, for Epictetus, I love this quote, questions are the engines of reason. So why bother having good reason? Well, for Epictetus, the marks of good reasoning are clarity, consistency, rigor, precision of definitions, and avoidance of ambiguity. So think for a moment, right? If we cultivate reason by working through questions honestly and rigorously, and we create a greater sense of clarity in our own thinking, we're more consistent, which might mean, right, we'll interpret this for a moment, that our thinking, let's say, just for argument's sake, makes more sense to us, right? And also we could even say, especially if we're examining our actions, which for philosophical meditation, we always are, right? Pretty much every session we talked about ways we act, ways we feel, ways we think. We might be able to be more consistent between how we think and how we act and how we speak. That's a good thing, right? If we're more precise in the way we define our emotions, our thinking, and our actions, in the way we define maybe friendship, in the way we define what we would like to have in a healthy romantic relationship, let's say, life might get better. If we were less ambiguous, if we were more clear with ourselves, life might get better. So why bother with this? Why bother maybe after the class, still examining some questions from the class? Or why even bother, let's say, and this is something that I find really helpful, right? Looking at life just, you know, with a greater sense of curiosity, starting maybe with challenges we face, instead of seeing them only as challenges, trying to phrase them as questions, right? Getting used to this sort of posture, this Socratic posture of questioning the world and not just accepting it, questioning other people, questioning ourselves. And we flex our reason muscle, and that's useful, right? So in class, we confront the questions, and as I said, we confront them silently. The pursuit of self-knowledge and self-care authentically, for an educational philosopher named Angelo Carranza, right? I'm quoting from a piece of his called Silence as the Foundation of Learning, right? The pursuit of self-knowledge and self-care requires silence, right? We engage with these questions to almost lead us into a state of silent reflection and wonder on them, right? For Carranza, silence is the source of both discourse and self-knowledge. Okay, when we go into silence, especially with questions, right? He says, quote, nothing in this space exists but the birth of the self into the world of wonder, contemplation, and listening. That's from silence, right? The facilitation of silence is the communion with the self, this relationship with the self that allows the self to become aware of itself as a complete being. And I'm using the word self a lot here, right? That's a tough sentence I just said, but it's important. Because when we give ourselves, right, this opportunity to once again, maybe let's say exist in a state of wordlessness, we're really able to be uninfluenced in a way that is significant to how we can address, engage with, confront, and then shape ourselves. Right? For Karanfa, self-knowledge and self-care, right? That can lead to this kind of recreation of the self to, again, as we sort of talked about with Williams, confront our goals, be able to think about our own thoughts on things, cannot be realized without silence. So how can we maybe integrate a silence or a wordlessness into our final take-home practice? How do we maybe, for example, put on headphones, get the instrumental music, and then use that time to, as we already discussed many times in the class, right, address ourselves, to move towards this state of self-knowledge, self-care, and creation that is facilitated by silence. That for Karanfa, among others, requires silence. One of the exercises we did, I believe, during the podcast was, when was the last time you sat and listened to nothing, said nothing, and in quotes, right, did nothing? Because that, of course, that is doing something. But ultimately, that was getting us, hopefully, to think about this notion of silence. There's power here for Karanfa. He argues that that's really, you know, at the heart of Socratic dialogue for Karanfa is the encouragement of silence. Socrates poses a question, right? That's discourse to his interlocutor, to the person he's speaking with. And it encourages this quiet reflection. To fully engage with the question he asks is to engage with the self in a mode that's uninterrupted. So silence, again, for Karanfa, is a source of something rich. It's a source of self-knowledge. Because in that silence, you're confronting yourself. Right? That's that state of contemplation. You're listening to yourself. It's wonder, right? Like we said, the questions encourage wonder too, of course. Because they encourage you to grapple with something with a degree of uncertainty. You're not just memorizing it. Right? There's power in that questioning, as we already established a little bit with Epictetus. Right? The engine of reason implies contemplation, implies wonder. You're not storing anything. It's not the fridge of reason, right? It's the engine, right? Engines make you go. They make you go forward towards truth, towards, again, this recreation of the self that you can work to define for yourself. And silence facilitates that. So, the power of questioning, the power of silence. We talked a little bit earlier, right, about this idea of grounds for the land, right, with the Williams quote. Like, so I think of soil, right, and I think of gardening to an extent too. You water the soil and something comes out of it. Like that water, to kind of run with this analogy, that's the questioning, that's the silence. Then out of that comes leisure, comes this wonder, these questions, this confrontation with the larger questions of life, the larger questions of the self. Silence and questions are fuel for, they're water, they're nutrients for leisure as an important, essential thing that we need as humans. So a questioning practice, a practice of silence, these are all pathways to that healthy, necessary part of our humanity. So of course, as we've, of course, you know, said many times, another way to, or let's say, things to add to a questioning silence practice, which again, both of those are powerful in and of themselves, as I hope I established a moment ago, as fertile soil for self-knowledge and self-care. Now, of course, you might want to add the self-writing and the reading. So for Karanfa, we're sticking with him a little bit here, right? Reading and writing involve a conversation with the silent self and with the silent other. So once again, there's power here. There's usefulness here for caring for the soul. Okay, so we include the self-writing as a mode, of course, as we've said many times, about, you know, a mode of caring for the self. Okay, and we have to work again to keep that silence, not to keep remarking upon if we were in class together, but just for a moment, right? The 10 to 15 minutes of meditation, you writing with the questions, is followed by the shorter texts in our bibliotherapy book. 10 minutes to consider those, still in silence. Why? Because for Karanfa, it is the silence of reading and writing that engages students in the process of self-understanding, a process or an art achieved through the unity of knowledge and practice, or of technical skills and feeling or warmth. Right? So this is an opportunity to engage with, let's say, the reading as an interlocutor, as someone with whom you're speaking. So the reading takes on a discursive, or let's even say a dialogical element. Don't just read to read. Right? My hope, again, in our class is that we're not reading just to memorize. Right? The take-home exercise is asking us, I think and I hope, to move beyond memorization. We're talking about application here. So in the process of reading, we're engaged in the process of self-understanding because you have to see the reading in your own way. And I hope my questions too that I provided on the syllabus, right? What does it say? What does it mean? How can I apply it? Why does it matter? These are questions that move beyond memorization. And when we confront that in silence, again, we're really combining some powerful things here. When you silently confront a reading, especially in the context of the pursuit of self-care, self-knowledge, consciously, the reading becomes an antidote, becomes medicine, maybe. To use some analogies, I'm going to share a little bit now from Michel Foucault. He talks about self-writing as a weapon in spiritual combat. So the reading is the same thing too, right? That quote that you not only memorize, but I think this is coming from Epictetus, very much a Stoic notion. You kind of embed the quote into your soul because you live it. It's ready to go. It's a tool now. It's a technique that you can apply. So reading, making time for silent reading. On another note, right? There have been studies, and I hate to say something general like that, and I apologize, but I can't remember, but it's a good point, so I'm going to make it, right? There are studies that one of the things that has been proven to increase happiness in our sort of very, digitized screen world is reading a physical book. If you make time to sit with a physical print book or any form of print media, again, let's add silence to that. It's been shown to increase happiness. There's something to that. Again, self-writing, physically, grabbing a piece of paper, grabbing a pen. There's something somesthetically, there's something bodily meaningful about these things that help us, that bring us joy. Right? So let's go to writing for a second here. So this is from Michel Foucault's book, Ethics. Right? The page becomes a place for, quote, written notations of actions and thoughts, as I hope we've been embodying that already, right? We engage with the soul, and for Foucault, quote, the constraints that the presence of others exert in the domains of conduct, right? Writing will exert in the domain of inner impulses. So we can learn to watch ourselves. We can learn to learn about ourselves. We can learn to cultivate the virtues of discipline on these inner impulses through writing. Writing provides a better vantage point from which we can see our own thoughts and feelings and actions. And that's very important in this process. Right? That's that soul engagement with a greater degree of clarity as we write and we judge our own thoughts. From the beginning of the semester, we've said from Epictetus, right, to judge our own thoughts with both kindness and, let's say, a critical eye. Critical doesn't necessarily mean negative. I think we hope that it means truthful, right? But even when we're, let's say, criticizing ourselves, we want to do so in a way that doesn't just leave the criticism, but encourages our growth and our development. Right, so I'm hoping, once again, that this will encourage us to not only think about our take-home final exercise as profoundly as possible, but also that these few notes on silence, questioning, the power of these things, self-writing, reading, these are all potentially powerful therapeutic philosophical approaches to thriving. When we're silent and we read, we can grow. more effectively. When we're silent and we write, we can grow more effectively. When we confront questions and we use these tools, silence, writing, reading, to cultivate self-knowledge, self-care, it might help us thrive. So I hope this was encouraging. Thank you all for listening.